All right, well, I'm going to start with a poem called This Life. And you'll see as I read this poem. This is one I wrote a few years ago. This Life. This life is a good life. A lucky life in a Bar Harbor spring in 1999 with the sun backs in the sliding glass doors and three birds practice their solos for the next millennium. I'm not living in it, but this life is good. A hand-thrown mug of coffee tasting as thick as the ashes of Troy. The faces of women I've loved coming back to this life, this good, good life that lives in May with birds, with a plump gray cat sprawled in a sun patch like the emperor of spring. My God, but it would be a decent life to live the life I live. I yearn for it sometimes in dreams when I am far off riding the shrunken boards of a ship, thirsting for that one green spot of the land that will be my home. Bandcamp. We were so proud of our fists of vodka, lying next to each other in Tom's trumpet case, like two long crystals harvested from the dark cave of high school's first 3 years. And while less fortunate kids fingered over and over through that one difficult passage, Tom and I floated around campus cracking jokes and chatting up the prettiest girls, the prettiest, most serious of whom was Amy, who came up to me after with her saxophone draped around her tan neck and decreed that we should all drink beers that night, me having used that ridiculous line when we met. And lo, she had already gotten some drooling 21-year-old from town to stack them behind a bush, and when, after a day of careening back roads in her friend's mom's car and belting with Tom, the Doors and whatever else came to mind, the other kids were jerking uncomfortably to that summer's teeny bop at the band camp dance. Amy and I strolled beneath those genuine college campus trees, making out whenever we felt like it. I see that I have descended again to loving those days, though. When I woke up in the middle of the night, remembering those two bottles nestled in the case, I was thinking what a waste I had made of band camp. That but for drinking and drugs later and all those tan necks, I might have been a real musician in a real ensemble wearing an honest-to-God bow tie gliding through important passages. One of those nights before I went back to the cave from which I was too proud to return letters, I snuck her into my room where, in the moonlight, on clinically white bed sheets, I revealed myself as a klutzy 16-year-old and she as a good Catholic. After doing nothing of lasting importance, exhausted, half-crazed, and half as someone woken up after a long sleep, and having no idea what a regretful, sober man I would be at 32, I said, "I love you," and she said, "Do you mean it?" And I, having not yet learned the scales, the passages of I don't know, said yes. Yeah, having a moment settling down into this scene here. So any chuckles are appreciated. This poem is called Poem. With the hope yet of writing a poem this morning, I'm sitting in the middle of the kitchen where I can see from the window across the sink the early winter light bringing the old oak to magnificent relief and can hear the radio's classical guitar asserting itself and struggling to reach doubt. And I am reading from the book of Job, "Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth?" And watching a spider descend by virtue of his own guts across that oak shining as from another earth and touch down on the sink divider and make for some attractive crevice. Just being here, there is no such thing, I think, as I hear now Bernstein's drifting violin above some kind of ground that keeps giving way, a piece inspired by Plato's Agathon. Beauty is a call to labor. With the hope yet of writing a poem smoothing like a coin-rubbed faceless, I watch a single crow pumping the blue he is the absence of, working it hard until the black of the last trees takes him. Well, I'm going to read a couple of new poems. Those are from the book. And I saw Betsy Scholl read a couple weeks ago, and she said at some point in her reading, we poets always feel like a fraud unless we have something new. So on that note, I'm going to read a few poems. Fight that ever-present feeling of fraudulence that comes along with being a writer and subjecting people to your work. Some different things. This is sort of an experimental poem. On Making Love With You Again, with words taken from an article about Wilson's quest to form the League of Nations. It's almost ideological with me, the requisite return, onerous with melodramatic lust, to flush the last thwarted bird to humiliated flight. At this point, indisputable. And what now of our utopian past, our formidable friendship, our hearts brokered open in those grueling nights that I, in putting down, espouse? I haven't the stomach for martyrdom, Kate, and this rigidity is like some covenant engrossing me in all the obscure senses of the word, like any word, equitable, territorial, subject to no treaty. Here's another poem in that vein where I sort of went through a magazine and called out a bunch of lines and then toyed around with them. The silence shrouding the country. The silence shrouding the country was broken. I saw Jesus without the miracles, Picasso, Twombly, Callas, and Hendrix. Impossible new science and technology. The war of the world just narrowly survived by hunkering down in its trenches and faking its own death. In a way, it was sport. A detail from the East Frieze of the Parthenon, how the Israeli press misreported the outbreak, and classical music without fear, burrowing into the screw holes of the brain. I thought hard about what it means to be poor today, Phidias busy with freestanding statues, mainly outsides. How do we summarize the relationship, given a life marked by more than one tragedy, living in Paris in the 20s, the communist movement in my toe, the denial of God's transcendence in deliberately obscure language? The great composer entertained the brutal dictator. Akhmatova began writing. Further details are available on our website. I saw Joseph and the angel. I saw native insurgencies and the genocidal impulse. I saw preaching from a pulpit of bones, the integrity of the particular case. Virtually every cartoon ever published in the New Yorker. And here and there we could spot the sad, cheap family heirlooms, the American venture, the ever-present possibility of renewal. I write a lot of poems about old lovers. We're talking about this at dinner. And poems themselves can become like old lovers in some ways. And somehow it's important, if you're going to do such a thing, to fight the nostalgia of that impulse, to fight the sort of sickly sweetness of the past, which is always with us. And I think a lot of what poetry does is to try to combat that. And that it can be a balm for the belief in the unreal sweetness of the past. And so this is one of those poems that I think struggles with that. Linda trying on clothes. What's back there in 1997 except the emptiness of the self leaned back on a bed laid on the floor while Linda tried on clothes for me in the mock domesticity we use to justify our furious bouts of fucking and the sweet sore picking of parting? Just summer outfits. Which must have had some meaning to her as she spun semi-ironically around, tugging at skirts until they made an opaque window onto her great ass, and the ever going back to pink-nippled bareness in the least philosophical way possible. Or was it? The outfits those years took on lie heaped like the aftermath of some sale day binge, scenarios of love and caprice and even sincere hope we played out to entertain ourselves while whatever it was that needed to work its way through us did so, like we with the clothes. I can't stop believing we were also the people, clenching in the sail binge piles, snagging what we could. Let's see, and what would that be? To the unborn. We have smoked all the cigarettes and sold the last pack years ago. But I think you'll thank us once you read the research. That much we took upon ourselves. So remember, smoking kills. Beware of radiation, mercury, and ground-level ozone. And for God's sakes, wear your seatbelts in whatever kind of wacky cars you make. We've left some ideas for those, by the way. What else? Enjoy the place. We wish it could have been better, but we had long retirements, most of us. And you know how expensive that can be. How time flies. I must admit, we were caught off guard by some things. We hope you get along, but if you don't, there are plenty of nuclear weapons for you to use. Just keep in mind, they really should be launched by democratic nations, otherwise all hell could break loose. Sorry about the farmland, but at least there's a copy of the latest food pyramid lying around somewhere. So eat healthy. And remember to take life one day at a time. Lord knows it gets by quickly. The secret of our happiness, I'd say, was in accepting what we could not change. Well, like most of us poets, I'm very interested in the self, particularly my own self. I'm not sure why that is. It just is, and so I just kind of go with it. And recently I've been working on a project to just kind of take it to the extreme and either work my way through it or get something out of it. A series of self-portraits. I'm going to read one of those. Self-portrait in the glass of a painting. Face, you will be my emissary when I am gone. And what will you tell them? You seem ready to say I ruptured my own spleen with laughter, that I sought some lost planet everywhere with dwindling hope, I, who could not find basil in the grocery store without help, that I was bored in the way the deaf become uninterested in hearing music after a great explosion, that I was more or less equal in hate and love, despised them both. O words, you also say only what pleases yourselves. They will know as little of me as of these water drops painted here, this painting mentioned here, this here. A couple of sonnets. If only this Baroque music could go on, not get blasted back to oblivion by the morning news, how many blown to bits in which inscrutable square, the ever-prolix spokesmen for the gated venturing forth to say there is still no comment, still no court where the tortured can testify, but if we wait, a little food may later be tossed over the gate. Not get bullied forward to the dismemberment of tone from tonic's purpose, all hope rent from the staggering soliloquy, a shift that must come or this music cuts adrift of history's harbor where we've pulled in all the boats against the rumor of a squall. I'm going to read a couple historical poems. I worked on a series of poems about World War I recently. It began as a letter from an old professor of mine in response to, I suppose, the kind of poems I've been reading, where he said, why don't you write a poem about the Brest-Litovsk Treaty? And I didn't even know what the hell that was, so I figured that was a good place to start. Probably everybody here knows. it was a treaty signed between the Russians and the Germans, or at least between the Bolsheviks and the Germans. The Bolsheviks signing this sort of devil's bargain to get out of World War I in order to assert themselves, that they wouldn't be attacked by the Germans, and in exchange, they would not enter into the conflict. So I'm going to just read a couple of these poems that were inspired by pictures from World War I. The Brest-Litovsk Treaty. Trotsky and Joff, ever intellectual in those little round glasses that have lately come back into rage, rolling to the treaty table in the back of a great open car on a brisk Brest Litovsk morning. Joff with one arm propped on the side, as people do now in Boston and Prague, studying the camera's lens that has lately become this writer. Trotsky slunk in an upturned collar, a man amused by deconstructionism in an L.A. bar, his Charlie Chaplin bowler the only reason to suspect these are otherworldly men sent forth from a pitchforked empire, and now he can begin to guess at what they might be willing to sign. The 24th Motor Machine Gun Battalion being inspected, 1917. We have gotten so used to things that kill that it may take a moment for the utter absurdity for these machines to sink in. Primitive motorcycles with exposed intestines and old lady handlebars, mounted with machine guns on one side and one of those squeeze ball horns on the other that clowns pull out of polka dot pants. Not a smile among them, however, these men who stand as erect as the wars last year will let them, hands clasped behind, between the row on row of Wizard of Oz machines parked straight as gravestones. They cannot see the sleek jets darting over Iraq as I write this poem, casually demolishing from the stratosphere one well towns. They cannot see themselves. Selection of German weapons captured by the Canadians in their advance to Cambrai, 1918. If you had taken in like a tourist the rest of the book's photos, of course this is what would be left. Neat rows of guns in the dust of old film. Meticulously laid, they round a corner and blur into a dark thicket from which only the cannons in back are still recognizable, their long necks craning to see the next cathedral. Any questions? Yes?
Well, I'm curious, not about a specific poem necessarily, but as a music composition major myself, how you feel that plays into your poetry now. I obviously hear a lot of references, but how exactly do you go from music composition, and do you still write music as well?
I don't write music anymore. It seems to take such an immersion to do it at all well, like so many things. It's hard once you've experienced what it's like when you really throw yourself into something and what can happen. Not that I was a great composer, but just the kind of the magic that can come from that. It's hard to just dub around with it, and I don't have the time to be serious about it. So no, I don't really write music anymore. But I think that all creative processes are sort of linked in some mysterious way that I certainly don't fully understand, but it seems like once you've kind of made a little step forward in one area, you kind of learn how to make steps forward, creative, how to sort of walk in the dark through something a little bit. So I find that maybe I gained a little bit of trust in what can happen if you let the subconscious work while I was writing music. And maybe some sort of muscle memory kinds of things, to use an analogy. The same way, you know, you kind of learn how to swing a bat, and after a while you don't think about it. I think some of those processes come through in writing poems. And it's sort of disconcerting, but for me it seems like the best stuff that I'm able to write is often the stuff I don't even understand what I'm doing while I'm doing it, you know, and I just kind of let the words come out, and then later I'm like, oh, that's what I meant. Processes come through in writing poems. And it's sort of disconcerting, but for me it seems like the best stuff that I'm able to write is often the stuff I don't even understand what I'm doing while I'm doing it, you know, and I just kind of let the words come out, and then later I'm like, oh, that's what I meant. I didn't know it at the time. All right, I'm going to read a couple more. And then if anybody else wants to talk about poetry, you know, I hope you will. I'll stick around afterwards. A Room with a View, This is a poem that uses the book A Room with a View. And all you really need to know about the book, in case you haven't read Forrester's novel, is that it has a ridiculously happy ending. Small Town plays off of that. How fortunate that last meeting with Mr. Emerson in the church. How much like an intervention of God or the writer. And that Lucy would see his meaning and understand at last that she loved George, and that George would not have offed himself or left the country or put himself in a death-like trance calling forth the need for unreliable messengers. This is all very fortunate. Not to mention being born with money and good looks and not in that day and age having died or been disfigured by one or another then horrifying diseases. I see once again that love is for the very lucky, or else there is some will that will not, generally speaking, be frustrated by details. Will you, M., now insurmountable in your other life, wander someday into my church confused and be turned toward the life I have long imagined? This book made it seem as though you would, and for that, I threw it at the wall. It's somewhere out of sight in another room. The singers I prefer. The singers I prefer are the ones who have to struggle. Famously, there is Bob Dylan and Robert Plant, who might have sung lower but didn't. And now there is this Beth Orton who seems to be singing through a wall. Through a wall? I would really like to get this right. Granted, the perfect voices on the radio today singing the Ode to Joy made me cry, but I was thinking, in between the floating, the deep hunger of dream memories, of deaf Beethoven locked in his smelly room, Beethoven who probably never had a woman groan his name in the clutch, scribbling each note at an audience of clefts and inkwells. It was after her face had been scarred in the accident when her mouth would only open on one side when it tasted of acrid medicines and something death-like that I saw for the first time how beautiful M was, how damn funny, if not through a wall, then through some almost crippling pain, the kind that threatens to blot out all the sweetness, even the bursting through of 100 ecstatic voices in a pickup truck in Bangor, Maine, in a snowstorm, after a long sadness. On hearing that you feel bad after having sex with me. Well, I feel bad too, S. Bad that my coming isn't tangled up with Sibelius gestures, with the hope of finding some way to die, with smoking and laughing all the way home, with being rock bottom right at last, with carrying your stones gladly through the streets, with a fog lifting of boredom supreme, with the livening of old houses, old palms, old trees into soul furnishings, with the certainty death's only reason is to drive us apart, with a movie-like confidence in any conclusion, with a gentle pity for the cashiers and janitors and CEOs who are not us, with a thinning down to paper all that's touchable, with cutting to chase after chase, with standing alone in the rain of my own funeral, with beating for any war that would unrape you, with knowing this is good, respectable work, this screwing away the morning cramped on a couch while just beyond the silence of our groans, this truceless life wages on and fucking on. All right, let's see. Two more poems. This is going back to my ute. As Matt said, I grew up in rural Maine, which was an interesting place for someone who would someday be a poet to grow up. Went to public school, and this is, I don't know if it's like this for all of you, but for me, in my deepest dreams, when I'm really, really sunk down to my core self, these days from my childhood just come back so vividly, and it seems like there's always something true in there somewhere. In a number of my poems, sort of get focused that way. And this is one of them, the school bus. In the dream, I was getting on the school bus. From the back of the bus, for some reason, only this time, instead of jeers and everyone sliding over to the aisle side so I couldn't sit down, someone said, "There's a seat up here, Chris." It was next to Mary Jo Stillwell, pretty as she was in eighth grade, who had slid to the window to let me sit. And when a kid put me in a headlock, I simply lifted him over my head and set him in the seat in front of me, said, "Stay there." And a little boy had grabbed a little girl by the hair, only this time I pulled him off and sat him down, saying, "You don't ever grab a girl," and sat her down too and asked her if she was all right. No one jeered at this or swore at me or threatened my life for disrupting the way things were supposed to be on the school bus going to Mountain View Middle School in Sullivan, Maine, if that's even where we were going. When I sat back in my seat, Mary Jo leaned forward in a very serious manner, and I kissed her as though it were the most natural thing to do with Mary Jo. Short, serious kisses on that school bus that was nothing like any school bus I had ever ridden, that was exactly like every school bus I have ever ridden. And when she started kissing my neck in a way that tickled, I woke up exactly in my life. All right, one last poem. I'm going to read another sonnet. Can you? Can you love the dawn and hate the day? I do. Addicted to the beginnings of relationships, as I've been told and told and told. The new light looks as something else when it first hits. Something more like Catherine standing up across a strangered room. That promising look she had before the promises, still stuck with sweetness to her face in my notebook of pre-day ecstasies. I love the feel of gray seeping into black, what it represents, the casting out that could occur, and the real, truant world opening before it grows dense with light and the need for endings, setting free that inkling some lasting love might come to me. Thank you.